Good afternoon, everyone. We are going to consider, as we've been over the last few weeks, about 3 weeks ago, I talked about thoughts and the intents that are going on within our thinking and our minds. And then last Lord's Day evening, we talked about the dangers of the tongue. And so I wanted to speak tonight about the eye. And the eye has two facets to it. One is the physical nature of it and the things that we physically see, but then there is a spiritual aspect that we'll end up talking about at the end of the lesson. Your eye is it's an incredible organ. It's a part of your body, and I've even brought lessons on the many aspects of the eye and the nerve and the optic nerve and the retina and how all that produces sight. It's a very complex piece of creation that God has made. But your brain processes what your eye physically sees. So your eyes allow you to have vision that then your brain interprets, and based on what you see, it is sometimes how we react. A beautiful sunset, or maybe a beautiful scene. We often will proclaim something like how awesome God is when we see His creation. Maybe there's an object that's in the road, and what do you do when you see an object in the road? Well, you have to avoid the object, so you'll swerve the car or move to not hit it. You see a shirt in the store that you like, and you say, oh, your brain says, oh, I like what I see, and so you decide, well, I'm going to buy that. So you see a newborn baby, and it just brings all kinds of emotions, and your heart is overwhelmed with all kinds of love. And as we know, also, there are things that we visually take in that may very well be sinful. And so in 1 John chapter 2, verse 15 and 16, the Bible talks about and kind of, in a sense, categorizes sin into areas. And he says there in verse 15 of 1 John chapter 2, do not love the world or the things in the world. If one loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Verse 15, verse 16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. So it's true that while we may have things that we visually see that bring about good thoughts and good emotions, we can also have visual things that are sinful and we need to be mindful of, and that's the kind of things that we'll be talking about. When you think about the mind, I found this statistic about our eyes and the things that take place. We do know, this was something that I read, and I've got the quote here. It says, we do know that when our eyes are open, our vision accounts for 2/3 of the electrical activity of the brain. And I thought that was, this is a 1957, by the way, article that was referenced. And so I thought, I wonder how this has changed. But you know, even if it's not 2/3 and it's a half, that's a lot to say that the amount of electrical activity when our eyes are open is what is accounting for that activity. But then it went on to say a full 2 billion of the 3 billion firings per second, which is what's taking place in this 2/3, this 2 billion of the 3 billion firings of, you know, the electrical signals that are taking place, 2 of the 3 billion in every second is also speaking of the activity that is happening from the eyes. And this was the finding, as I said, of a man back in 1957. But depending on what is going on in our thoughts and our intentions, like we looked at a couple weeks ago, our eye can be good or our eye can be evil. And the Bible speaks of that in this way. In Matthew chapter 6, let's look at a few passages. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 22 and 23, in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, the lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And I'm going to come back and consider that particular passage just a little bit more in just a moment. But also in a Luke 11 passage, Luke chapter 11, where this is also found, this same type of thought. There's a little bit of difference found here, so let's look at it as well. He says, "The lamp of the body is the eye. Therefore, when your eye is good, your whole body is full of light, and when your eye is bad, your whole body is full of darkness." And so the eye can, a way to perhaps look at this is the eye can let in light or good, or the eye can let in darkness, that which is bad. And so just look at it as the Bible talks again about how the eye can be good or the eye can be evil. Sometimes there are things, and I think of David going out on his rooftop, but I think all of us have experienced when there are times we do not have control over what we see. I don't know which of the kids saw this or did not see this, but on our way to services years ago in Richmond, I stopped at the bank, and there was a gentleman that was standing at his car, and he apparently had finished running, and so he's got his car door open, and he's blocking himself, what he thinks is from the street and all the people in town that's there, and there's a lot of activity at this little corner. But what he didn't think about was who's behind him, and he started changing his clothes. And I was standing there at the bank going, okay, he didn't pay any attention to where he was at and who might be seeing this. And, of course, you got your five young kids. I know who does that, right? But again, I had no control. I wasn't expecting to see something like that. And that happens. There are times that things like this happen. On the other hand, there may be times that we're actually seeking out. And I think of the subject of pornography, where my eyes go looking for it. And that is, again, something that is real and is and can be a problem. In Matthew chapter 5 and in verse 29, Jesus, again, in the Sermon on the Mount, to get an idea of how you can sin, he says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out, cast it far from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than that your whole body be cast into hell." And again, we'll be looking at that passage again. But, you know, our sin, like we were talking about this morning, can cause us to, things that we see cause us and can cause us to in fact sin. So there's a seriousness about that in this passage that is, you know, we were talking about hyperboles on Wednesday. Does Jesus want us to go cutting our hands off and plucking out our eye? That's very strong language. And it really does lend itself to the realities of, yeah, you really would want to do that if you cannot, in fact, control the eye and the hand. But I don't think that he thinks that we should ever get to a point that we would do that, because we understand the seriousness of what he is talking about. And he says in that you'll be cast into hell fire. And so that is a seriousness about what we're talking about in the eyes and what the eyes can and do take in. And it is a lamp unto the body. And we also know in Mark 7, verse 20 and 21, Jesus said, What comes out of a man, that defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceeds evil thoughts, adulteries, fornication, and murders. And that, again, talks about, you know, what comes out. Well, how do certain things get in there? Well, one of the ways that things get into our mind, into our heart, into our thoughts, is through the things that we visually see and allow ourselves to see. And so we need to be mindful of that. And so our lesson is going to deal with the seriousness of this. And then, as I said, towards the end, we'll switch over to thinking about this from a spiritual perspective of sight, and then the lesson will be yours. There are some biblical examples of an evil eye. If you go to Genesis chapter 3, we know when Eve partook of the fruit that was on the tree that she and her husband were told, Adam, do not eat of the tree that's in the midst of the garden. You can eat of any tree. We know that it's very clear that God gave them specific instructions. Eve knew those instructions. But notice what it says in verse 6, after the serpent has deceived her and lied to her. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of the fruit and ate, and she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. You know, this language is here for our learning, and you've probably heard lessons before that talks about even in her sin here, you see the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life in this sin. And this is when sin enters into the world, and it happens, and it begins with the devil is deceiving her. He's getting her to doubt what God has said. She's told him what God has said. He says, well, you know, you're not going to die. And it's almost like she's saying he's not wanting you to have something that is good to you. And then what did she do? The first thing it says is she gazed, she looked, she began to look at that fruit that was on the tree. And when she saw the tree, and then all of a sudden what was forbidden becomes, that looks good. And notice it doesn't stop there, that it was pleasant to the eyes. And so it was, now, you know, it's really good. And because of that, she then sees that it's desirable. And so now she starts making, based on what she's seeing, she starts saying, oh, this is going to make me wise. So now what's the brain doing? Brain's picking up what the eye is seeing. And now all of a sudden, this fruit that they've been told not to eat becomes something that she decides to go ahead and reach out and grab it and actually eat what God had told her not to eat and give it to her husband, Adam. Her eyes convinced her brain that it was good. And that wisdom then kicks in, and that could be obtained from the tree of knowledge and good of evil. So here's an eye that was not good. There's another story over in Joshua chapter 7, and it is the story of when they conquered Jericho. They've marched around the city, but you'll remember that before they marched around the city and they were given their instructions, that they were told in Joshua chapter 6, they were given specific instructions. And here's what they were told. And you, chapter 6 and verse 18, by all means abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So they weren't supposed to take anything, and anything that was silver and gold, that was supposed to go to the house, as it says there, to the treasury of the Lord in verse 19. So basically, when you go in, the walls fall down, when you go in, you're supposed to abstain from all of the things and the spoil and the plunder. But you know what happened. Look at chapter 7. And you recall that when what happens next is Joshua then says, well, there's the little city of Ai over there. Let's just take it. Just send, and I forget how many, but just send a small amount. It's just a small city and take it. And they ended up fleeing from this city. And so now it's like, uh-oh, we've done something wrong. It's kind of like when Uzzah was struck dead and David said, what are we doing wrong? And now he had to figure out what they were not doing that they were supposed to be doing. Well, if you look at chapter 7 and verse 19, as different families and tribes, or tribes and families are brought before him, it whittles down to verse 19. Joshua said to Achan, My son, I beg you, give glory to the Lord God of Israel and make confession to him and tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me. So how do you get even to Achan? Think about our lesson this morning where did God know what was going on? Absolutely. And so, it's not that tribe. It's this tribe. Is that not that family, right? And all of a sudden, Joshua's looking right at the man saying, you need to confess. You need to tell me. And if you're Achan, you'd have to be standing there going, watching all this, and it's getting closer and closer and closer. Achan answered Joshua and said, verse 20, indeed, I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and this is what I've done. Now notice the language. When I saw among the spoils a beautiful silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekel, I coveted them and took them, and there they are hidden in the earth in the midst of my tent with the silver under it. Well, where did this start? With his eyes. And you think about thievery. Oh, I really want that shirt, but I can't afford that shirt. What do the eyes start doing? Where's the camera? Is anybody going to notice? Isn't that the way we behave? See, the eye can be good or it can be evil. And so here Achan has taken of this, and people died. His fellow brethren of Israel died because of his sin. And then he himself died as well. And then you think about King David over in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and how the sin that he commits and the shame that he brings upon the nation of Israel begins in the spring of the year. It says in verse 1 of chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, it happened in the spring of the year at the time when the kings go out to battle that David sent Joab and his servant with him and all of Israel. And they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. So there was the first problem, as the king was supposed to go out and he didn't. But then number 2, verse 2, then it happened one evening that David rose from his bed, walked on the roof of the king's house. And this is what I was talking about. And from the roof he saw a beautiful woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. Saw something that he did not expect. But we know that it led to adultery, it led to the death of her husband. In Job chapter 24 and in verse 15, the other passage that you have there, it says, the eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, no eye will see me, and he disguises his face. How many times that has been repeated? Over and over again. I wait till dark. No one will see what I'm doing. But we know full well that God always sees what we're doing. He disguises his face. And you think about how David acted and how his eye was evil. Now what's interesting is there's examples of a good eye. And now we're going to look, well, what about David? Well, there was times that what David saw and what David could have done, David did the right thing. And we have an example of that in 1 Samuel chapter 24. You remember that King Saul became jealous of David. He sought to kill him. He wanted to kill him. And there were two occasions where David himself could have struck down Saul, but he did not because he knew he was the Lord's anointed. But I want you to look at the language that's found here in 1 Samuel chapter 24 and verse 10. David has found Saul. David has spared Saul when he could have. And it's interesting, those around him would have thought he was great if he'd have struck him down. You can almost see those around him egging him on to do this. But look at verse number 10. As he is now communicating with Saul, he says to Saul, he says, look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave. What's he saying? Let your eyes look around, Saul, King Saul, look around and see that the Lord delivered me into your hand in this cave. So he's saying, figure out what you're seeing and realize that I could have killed you. And someone urged me to kill you. Now look at this. But my eye spared you. And I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. So what is he saying? You look around and see, I could have, and I had you. Realize the moment. But then my eye saw who this was, and I couldn't kill the Lord's anointed. So at that time, he was using his what he was seeing, the opportunities he had, and he chose to do what was right. And then there is Job. And Job, in his reasoning with his friends, there's a lot of back and forth discussion that is taking place. In Job 31 and verse 1, he said this. He said, I made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? And that is wise and wisdom for all of us, and especially for men. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Job knew the pitfalls that David himself did not see upon the gazing of a woman. And in his determination to have a good eye pleasing to the Lord, he made a contractual resolve, which is the idea of a covenant, to not allow his eyes, then his thoughts, to endanger his soul. In Psalm 119 and verse 37, and I didn't get this one up there, Psalm 119 and verse 37, the psalmist said, turn away my eyes from looking at worthless things and revive me in your way. So there are things that are not worth beholding and they're worthless and we're wasting our time and things of that nature. He says, you need to turn your eyes away. And that's exactly what Job had done, and he had made this covenant with his eyes. You think about just think a moment about what's being said. Your eyes are a part of your body, and you're making a covenant with a part of your body, saying you're not going to do that. And all that's taking place, of course, in the mind. And so the mind is going to control the eyes, isn't it? And that always has to be the case. That's how we look away. That's how we walk away. That's how you flee, is when we see what's going on and we make the choices and the decisions to have a good eye instead of an evil eye. And there's another interesting passage over in Proverbs 22 and verse 8. Or excuse me, 9. Proverbs 22 and verse 9. And so I've titled it, anyone with a generous eye is a good eye. And that's the language that is used here in Proverbs 22 and verse 8. I didn't turn fast enough here. He who sows iniquity, wait a minute, verse 9. He who has a generous eye will be blessed, for he gives of his bread to the poor. That's a good eye, isn't it? Well, what is that saying? What's a generous eye? Well, it's exactly what it means. It means that my eye sees opportunities and it takes advantage of those opportunities to do good. And so our eyes can see and be looking for opportunities. It may be that I see an opportunity to teach somebody. It may be an opportunity that I see to be benevolent to someone. As he mentions here in the passage, a generous eye is going to look for opportunities. And that's a pun. What does a generous eye look like? What does a generous eye look like? Well, it is one that is going to be looking for those opportunities to do the good. In Proverbs 23 and verse 31... you might just have to flip over. It says, do not look on wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. Of course, this section really lays open the fallacies and the downfalls of alcohol and intoxication. But notice what happens is he says, and you picture, what are people doing when they're doing this? They're looking upon it. Well, you know, he says, when you don't look upon this, because it's like, oh, that looks so good. And then before you know it, you're intoxicated. And he's telling us that we need to be able to perceive those occasions and make the right choice. Also in Psalm 94, just back up into the book of Psalm 94, and in verse 9, he who planted the ear, shall he not hear? He who formed the eye, shall he not see? And that just reminds us again that God is always watching. Now, there is a parable that is taught, and that is, that one goes with this one right here. The parable that is taught is about the Good Samaritan, and that is, we're not going to take the time to look at this in Luke chapter 10. But in the parable of the Good Samaritan, the language is like we're talking about. The Levite saw him, didn't do anything. The priest saw him, didn't do anything. But we looked at this the other day. What did the Samaritan do? No, when he saw him, and he saw this man that had been beat up, obviously robbed, what did it say? It said he had compassion on him. The eyes saw and saw opportunity to do good. And that's Jesus is talking about. The one who was his neighbor was the one who actually had compassion and helped him. Well, the passage that was our scripture reading and where our sermon title came from is Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 8, where it says, "The eye is not satisfied with seeing." And the real challenge that confronts us is our desire for more and more and more. We see this and that shiny object. I want another. I want this. I want that. And that's something that is easy to overcome us. And this is particularly true when it comes to stuff. The eye desires what it sees. And he says it's never satisfied. It wants more and more. And so I have to take that to heart and say, well, this is a problem that we have as man, and it's something that we have to conquer. Solomon speaks of insatiable desire for more of what one sees. In fact, we're blessed to have the book of Ecclesiastes, which we studied, because Solomon says to us, basically, he says, I did it. You don't have to do it. Let me tell you what I found. And he had the resources to say, if I wanted more, I could get more and I could do more. But remember what he said when he got to the end. He said, it's vanity. It's chasing after the wind. And so I can take that to heart and recognize that the eye, though it is not satisfied, what is my responsibility? Well, the passage there in Proverbs 28 and verse 22 tells us a man with an evil eye. We're back to, do I have a good eye or an evil eye? A man with an evil eye is going to hasten after riches and does not consider the poverty that will come upon him. Because who's truly rich? You know, there may be a lot of people that they chase after riches and they die with riches. But they're bankrupt spiritually and they're not rich at all. They have not laid up their treasures in heaven. The man with an evil eye will hasten after riches. And there are those that it's just always about making a buck and always about more and more and more. And that's why Christians need to learn contentment. Before we look at a couple of passages on contentment, look at Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 8. You may still be there. Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 8. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. but he never asked, "For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune." Basically, that's the man that has pursued riches, and when he gets done, he doesn't have anybody. Doesn't have anybody to leave it to. There's nobody to, and there he sits with all of his things. Very vivid picture. And that's why we as Christians must learn the lesson of contentment. And so Paul has a couple of things to say about that in Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4, verse 11 and 12. This is a lesson that's good for all of us to be reminded of often, because it is something that confronts us. Our eyes take things in, our eyes desires things, and there comes a time where we need to be satisfied with what we have. And so Paul said in verse 10 of Philippians chapter 4, verse 11 beginning, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, I know how to abound everywhere in all things. I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need." If you have, you're content. If you don't have, you're content. Content means that you realize that there's nothing in the things and that you can be happy with little, or if the Lord has blessed you with a lot, that you would use those blessings. Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 8, he says, having food and raiment, that there's where you need to be content. Just having food and raiment. And that just strips us down to the very basics and says, this is the base level. And if you can learn to be content with that, when the blessings come, you're still content and thankful every day for the blessings that you have. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, you recall that the Hebrew writer said, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." So God's with us, and be content. Don't be coveting things and desiring, because the passage says the eye will never be satisfied. So something has to overrule the eye, doesn't it? And that's going to be the way that we think and the attitudes that we have about monetary things, physical things, knowing and understanding that this too will pass away. You can't take it with you. Never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul trailer, because those things are simply true. And as I mentioned, we'll close now with this last thought, and that is with our spiritual sight, because the Bible certainly talks about seeing things that are not seen. And Brother Gary, I don't remember if you said it was a sign that you saw, but I remember I wrote it down. He said, I believe you said you saw a sign that said, seeing is believing. But then the other side of that is, no, believing is seeing. And he said, that'd make a good lesson title. And so that thought is saying we walk by faith and not by sight. And so let's look at just a couple of passages that speak to our figurative sight, because we literally do not see things that are not seen. And so my father used to call it your mind's eye, where in our mind we can see and long for heaven, and that's it's our walking not by sight, but of course by our faith. So if our eye can see things, we want to train our eyes to see things that you cannot see. Does that make sense? I think it does to us of faith. And so we have to do that. The sight that Moses had that allowed him to physically see all the riches that were in front of him in Egypt and refused that. Because you remember what the passage says in Hebrews 11 and verse 26? Turn, if you would, over to Hebrews 11 and verse 26. How could Moses make this decision to suffer with his people than to enjoy all the riches? Because he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure in Egypt, for he looked for the reward. What reward would that have been? He certainly couldn't see it. It wasn't something that he got binoculars or some kind of something and looked way off in the distance and he could see the reward. No, this is what he knew from the Scriptures. And he saw what was not visible to the naked eye. And that is so important for us as Christians. We walk by faith and not by sight. The spiritual eye allows each of us, and this is 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and in verse 18. This is a passage that just really nails this thought as we close. We'll begin in verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, so what are we going to look at? At the things which are not seen. Now, isn't that ironic? How do I look at things that's not seen? That's our point, right? The spiritual sight. For the things which are seen, they're temporal. But the things which are not seen, those things are eternal. Those things are eternal. And so we have to control the things that we see physically because they come into our mind, and then our mind and our heart respond to those things that we see. We have to learn to have it tuned into that which is good, shun that which is evil. We need to be content with the things that we have, and we need to make sure that our sight of heaven and the reward is crystal clear. That is something that the older we get, and that's the passage here, we're falling apart on the outside. But inside, boy, that picture of heaven is getting clearer and clearer, isn't it? It's getting more and more real the older that we get, the more mature in faith that we become. So in closing, are you prepared for that which is eternal? What have you set your sights on? On things that are above? Well, if you'll set your sight on things above, that's where your affections will be, where God is, and where we will spend eternity. If you're here this evening and you aren't a Christian, we want to give you that opportunity to become a child of God, having turned from your sin, confessing your belief in Christ, and being baptized to wash your sins away. Maybe you're a child of God and there's things that are amiss in your life. If you need to confess them, turning from them, we'll help you in any way that we can as together we stand and sing.